Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hi, I'm Tim Robinson, editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine, and I'm your host for this episode of Aviation Extended, Europe's top flight aviation podcast. It's just me this episode, but Peter, Gareth and Ellie will be back in future episodes. I'm just going to apologise at the moment for a little bit of cold, winter flu, what have you, in case anyone complains that I'm a little bit croaky or a little bit nasal this episode. But have we got an episode for you? I'm absolutely delighted to welcome to the show Scott Bateman, MBE, former C-130 pilot, professional aviator, TV host producer, and now best-selling author. Courtesy of Hercules, First In, Last Out, which was published last year. Scott, welcome to Extended.
Hey, Tim, thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, Scott, if people don't know Scott, why will you not know Scott? Scott is one of the saner voices on social media, all things aviation. It's absolute a delight to kind of follow his adventures and get his insights into aviation, safety, military aviation, and Hercules. Let's start off, Scott. How did you get your background? How did you get into aviation in the first place? What was the spark that got you into flying?
Oh, well, if I were to go back right to the very beginning, Tim, it would be an Airfix model.
Oh,
it was the Lysander Airfix model. My dad bought it for me, and the Lysander to this day remains my favourite aeroplane. If we looked at the Airfix model back then and how it ended up with gluey fingers and bits sticking out everywhere, it was rubbish. But that was what inspired me to think, I love this plane nonsense. I'm going to be a pilot. Wow. So my dad kind of fueled that a little bit, and we went to the when we had Battle of Britain at home days at RAF Lucas, we went to the RAF Lucas one, and I got to sit in an English Electric Lightning of Treble One Squadron. And oh my goodness, that was it. I thought, this is for me. This is like a spaceship. And little did I know, it actually was like a rocket ship. But actually, it was real fun for me to sit in that, and my dad bought me some posters. I put them up on the wall, and you know, a Phantom and a Lightning and all the airplanes of that era really excited me. I joined the Air Cadets, flew in a Chipmunk, and that was it. Jump, jump, John. Watched the video. And for me, that was it. I'm done. You know, I'm absolutely done.
The days of proper RAF adverts where they just had a picture of a Jag or a Phantom, and it was just kind of fly it and a little thing to cut out and send in to be a pilot.
It was amazing. It absolutely was amazing. And that kind of fueled my interest. Come to the end of school, I wasn't very academic, really not an academic person at school. Physics was about as far as I could get. Maths, not so great. So I got a load of O-levels, as they were back then, GCSE equivalent, and I didn't do so well in my A-levels, like flunked them all, actually. So I thought, right, I'm going to join the RAF anyway, because you only need 5 O-levels, as was back then. As an officer, I can still be a pilot, was what I thought. Went down there and to Biggin Hill, to the Officer Aircrew Selection Centre, and my enthusiasm versus their realism didn't really match up. So I joined the police. I joined the police service in Scotland and got accepted to the police service, was just about to start there, and lo and behold, I got an offer from the Royal Air Force to join as NCO air crew. What is that? And then I looked into it, found out that these were the people who hung out of search and rescue helicopters.
That's right, yeah.
And yeah, know me now and my totally rational fear of anything with a spinning wing, people would be astounded to hear that that was my career path. I decided I wanted to do that. And so I joined the Air Force, and as they say, the rest is history.
brilliant. Okay. And so I mean, that's a fairly unconventional kind of route, isn't it? In a little bit of way of coming up through the being the loadmaster and then. Then moving on to sort of pilot training. Were there many other people who went that route, or?
Yeah, well, back in the late 90s, there was just a paucity of pilots in the Air Force. You know, they were really struggling to get people to join as aircrew, very similar to now. And what they decided to do was take people who had previously applied but had gone to other aviation trades, NCO aircrew or non-commissioned aircrew or navigator even, and take them back and reselect them as pilots with a view of, giving them another go. So I had a couple of goes at this, didn't fare so well because you're much older now. Yeah. And just before my 26th birthday, I got this letter that said, "Dear Mr. Bateman, we think you could be a pilot. How would you like to start?" And that was it. I ended up leaving the Hercules fleet in 1997. 47 Squadron, and then went off for 3 years almost to the day. I rejoined 47 Squadron as a co-pilot, did a short co-pilot's tour of just over 2.5 years, and then stayed there as a captain for a couple of tours, then went off to do some other stuff. I went through elementary flying training with another famous author, Peter Tremelling. Tremors.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah, so he and I went through elementary flying training together.
Brilliant. Okay.
He was much better. He was much better at it than me, so that's why he ended up on the Harrier. Yeah.
But did being a loadmaster first, knowing the ins and outs, did that give you an advantage then in kind of knowing that the Hercules nose to tail, or was that perhaps in some respects a sort of a disadvantage in some, and maybe some kind of sort of snobbery from, you know, people who'd gotten straight in at pilots? And
Oh, goodness, no. I mean, this multi-crew environment, there's no snobbery at all, and everyone mucks in. So, you know, even the captain would be, you know, making the teas, putting the meals in and sweeping up down the back. You know, it's literally a Hercules as a team effort. It's not everybody does their own job. Everybody can have a go at everything and help with everything. Did it hinder me? I think the banter was harsher when I came back. Because I'd made the jump, you know, from non-commissioned aircrew to commissioned aircrew, and I think that was the banter was pretty ruthless. Yeah. But actually, it did give me an advantage in that I knew the airplane inside out. I hadn't really officially ever flown it, but the technical aspects of it, the loading, the weight and balance, how the oven worked, and crucially how the bev makers worked, I had all of those little bits nailed, which meant that I could just focus on the flying, which was fantastic.
And you obviously knew all the loadmaster practical jokes there that you might... Loadmasters might play on pilots, and you've done that before, so you've got a head of...
Yeah, but it didn't mean you didn't get caught out by them. A story which didn't make it to the book was I turned up in Bangor once, went to the customs hall, customs opened my suitcase, and he went, "Is this some kind of joke, sir?" And I looked at my suitcase, and it was full of passenger life jackets. And I went, "So where's my clothes?" And they said, "Oh, they're back at Lynham in the crew room." And we were away for 8 days, and they said, "Well, don't worry, we've bought some clothes for you." Yeah. And that was the most gopping shirt and trousers, and I had to wear those trousers for 3 days.
Top tip there: always keep your suitcase in, or your bags within kind of within eyesight, I suppose.
Only a fool is parted from his luggage.
Yeah. So Hercules, I mean. Obviously, someone who knows, has flown the Hercules, knows it well. Hercules, I have to say, it's a fantastic book. Really, really good book. If people haven't read it, why haven't you read it? What made you write it in the first place? I mean, there must be quite a few books on the C-130. Obviously,
actually, there isn't. There isn't that many. So there's a lot of books about the airplane itself and explaining, you know, how the airplane was built and that amazing story. But actually not an awful lot of books about operating it. And here we were coming to what was going to be, you know, the sunsetting of it from the RAF's point of view. And I actually was in the RAF club downstairs in the running horse having a beer and with a couple of friends, another friend of ours who'd written a book called Fabulous Finn about a police dog that had been attacked and changed the law. So Dave and I were sitting having a beer, and in came John Nicol, who's a friend of Dave's. We sat down, we had a chat, and John said, "Well, why don't you write a book?" I said, "I can't even speak English, John, never mind write it." And he says, "Well, actually, Dave knows somebody who can help you with that." And Dave introduced me to somebody who'd helped him on his book, Fabulous Finn, a lady called Lynn Barrett Lee, who is a very accomplished author, sold millions of books in her own right. Lynn became my translator from droll Scottish into readable English. It was a collaboration between Lynn and myself, and that's how it started. All the best stories start over a beer, don't they? And you've got John Nicol to blame for this one.
Okay. Well, no, I like to say it's a great book, and kind of not only your story, but the development of the Hercules and the crews that fly the missions. Some of them extremely hair raising. And kind of how it develops over time, and some of them stuff that in there that I consider myself fairly well up on, RAF history or military aviation. I'm looking there going, turning the page, going, "Oh, I didn't really know about that, what was happening at that time," So what was the biggest revelation or discoveries that you made? It with the bits in there that you looked at and you went, "Oh, crikey, I didn't realise that was happening either."
I think for me the there are about 20 odd stories in there, and they're not all mine. For your listeners, they're not all my stories. There's a lot of other people's stories in there, and I kind of bridge it with a bit of storytelling and some stories of my own. But the biggest sort of, not revelation, but the most interesting story for me to research was Entebbe and the raid on Entebbe. And it is by far the most audacious raid ever carried out by an air transport aircraft ever, even to this day. To fly four Hercules that they'd only had for a very short time on night vision goggles that they'd never flown with before, in formation for 4,000 miles below 100 feet, that is just astounding. Anyone who's flown an aeroplane will realize flying at 100 feet at any time is hard work, but to do it for 4,000 miles on MVGs in formation and know that people are out to get you, and they landed 20 seconds late.
Brilliant.
And that, when you put all of that into perspective, and the mission was a huge success, with the sad, fact that actually all the hostages were actually retrieved, and no deaths in the hostages. Unfortunately, one of the commandos died, and it was Yoni Netanyahu, who is the brother of Benjamin Netanyahu. It was the only Israeli to die in the raid, sadly.
Yeah, That does stand out, doesn't it, as sort of like the dam busters, I suppose, of the Herc world, as to this is what you can do, I suppose, with
But it showed the world really what they could do. It went from being really a Pickford's van with wings to a real tactical tool, and that was one of the pivotal changes in the journey of the Hercules, was that people actually viewed this aeroplane in a very different way now. It was viewed as a tactical tool that could actually go deep into enemy territory to deliver special forces to interdict against a specific target. And that was used, as you probably know, in a number of times stories in the book, where it didn't always end well, as it did in Entebbe, but it was a shift change, particularly as we were coming into the Gulf War some years later. That was a great story for me. One of the more lighter-hearted stories, I think, was the parachute jump to the QE2 by a very specialist team of, I think they were called negotiators from Hereford. The team of negotiators from Hereford, accompanied by the EOD expert, who only found out just before they got airborne that actually he was about to do his first parachute jump ever, and it was going to be into the North Atlantic to land alongside the QE2. That, for me, and when we did the launch of the book, Sergeant Clifford, who's mentioned there, who is one of the SAS troopers, one of the specialist negotiators, he came along and actually talked to us about that day. And I have to say, you could hear a pin drop in the room as he was trying to describe the words of wisdom that he was giving to this EOD tech before he jumped out of this aeroplane into this horrible, dark North Atlantic.
Because it was warm as well, wasn't it?
Oh, it was horrible, yeah. I mean,
Why there isn't a movie about this, I don't know.
Well, there is. There is a movie about it. Juggernaut. The movie. Yeah, they made the movie Juggernaut. That was the movie that was made back in 1977, 78. Look at it. It's a great movie, actually.
Right. Primed for a remake then, I think. the other thing that stands out from this book as well, and perhaps some of the sadder moments, is the Herc 74 seems very, very tight-knit. You know, you've got the crews. You've already said that everybody mucks in. Why do you think that is? Is it the fact it's multi-crew? You're deployed on your own as a single aircraft for these long periods. Everybody gets to know each other, and you have that camaraderie that kind of builds up.
It's a real collegiate feel to it, actually. You know, it really does feel like your family. Not only did we fly together, we socialized together, both in work and out of work. Our families all knew each other. So, you know, and it was, you know, we had families days. It was a very close-knit community. And everybody knew everybody, you know, and that actually was, you know, a great thing, particularly as we had an aeroplane loss. When you have an aeroplane loss, you know, that hits the family hard. And actually having that family around you, and I mean that squadron family, really does help you get through those tough times. And I don't think it's because we were any different. I think the fast jet squadrons were just the same. I just think we had bigger numbers because, you know, there was five of us, if not seven of us, with the two ground engineers every time we went away. And, you know, you really lived in those people's pockets for 6-8 weeks at a time on detachment. And you get to know them really well, really, really well in that 6 to 8 weeks. And, you know, occasionally you would go away with the same people over and over again just because of the scheduling. And, you know, they became family.
What was the favourite place you flew to then?
Oh, different things for different times. I think the most challenging. No, actually, you know what? Those kind of places are fun socially, but actually, from a flying viewpoint, not so much. I think from a challenging flying viewpoint, there's an island in the Bahamas called Andros, which sits on the tongue of the ocean, as it's called. And this is a very deep part of the ocean just off the Florida coast. And Andros is very well known to be a place where we do lots of submarine stuff. And we took some submarine equipment, which was very heavy, very, very heavy, onto Andros Island, which is an unprepared strip. It's very short, very short, even for a Hercules. And as we flew over it to do an airfield inspection, there were two airplanes at the end of the runway crashed. Oh. Who had actually gone off the end. Not Hercules, I hasten to add. They were working for a Colombian family import-export business, and they'd been doing some work at night, and they'd gone off the end of the runway and got caught. So we landed, and as you're turning around to see these crashed aeroplanes, recently crashed aeroplanes at the end of the runway, it really does focus your mind a little bit. But that was a really nice place. While we're offloading the load, we, you know, got out and sat on the beach and stuff, which was pretty cool. But from a challenging viewpoint, I think flying any aeroplane in an operational environment, particularly Afghanistan, where you've got that hot and high element almost with every airfield, with the turboprop, that's always going to be a problem. With any airplane, actually, hot and high is always going to be a problem. And when you're working with heavy loads almost every day, pushing the airplane to its military operating limits, not the normal civilian operating limits, it's really challenging. And I found Afghanistan challenging from that viewpoint, from a flying viewpoint.
And just to rewind a bit on the Herc Force, does that also kind of extend as well to the international community? Because obviously you think of the countries that are flown the Herc, still flying the Herc. It's the world's most popular airlifter, isn't it? So is there a... Can you go into a bar anywhere on a NATO exercise and go, oh, those lot in the corner of the Herc pilots?
Yes, you could. You will be able to identify them. The Herc crew will be identifiable, and you know, it's an amazing thing, isn't it? And even retired, we're friends, you know. So I did a talk last weekend in Cambridge Uni, and Larry, who did the talk with me, is an ex-Herc captain as well. And, you know, we've become great friends after we left the service because we had a common bond of Hercules. And, you know, it goes beyond your service as well, because people just go, oh, you're a Herc guy. Ah, you know, where's the party? we were famous for that. Famous for that. Well, you took your own disco with you everywhere you went, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I did like your story in the book about the USAF liaison officer or jump seating there into
Sarajevo.
Who asked, where's the armor on this thing, and what everyone sort of looked around and went, what armor? And he decided, they decided not to be the liaison officer from there on in, you know.
So that was a great story, because they used to go. We had an operation that ran for a long time during the siege of Sarajevo, where we went from Ancona in Italy into Sarajevo 3 or 4 times a day. 47 Squadron solely did that. A small unit within 47 Squadron did that detachment solely. And occasionally you would get USAF liaison officers go into the theatre of war, because it meant they would get their wages tax-free for that month. And it was ESF was what we didn't have fitted to the aircraft, which is this explosive suppression foam. So if you imagine the foam that, if you've ever done flower arranging, and I'm sure you have, some flower arranging, you know the blocks that you get that you can stick flowers in? Well, ESF is a little bit like that. Right. And what it does is it floats on top of the fuel. And there's a thing called ullage at the top of fuel tanks. And ullage is the bit where the air and the fuel vapor is. And actually, that's what will explode if you get a fire in there. It won't be the fuel itself. So this ESF, this foam, basically pushes that air out so you don't have any ullage. We didn't have that system fitted to our tactical airplanes, as the UK, all USAF airplanes were fitted with it. Ours weren't, because we never envisaged this airplane to be. It was a Pickford's van with wings. It wasn't a tactical tool that was going to go beyond the forward line of operating troops. And here we find it, you know, in Sarajevo, getting shot at every day, and not having that, and then subsequently in the Gulf War. We lost an airplane in Iraq and sadly lost 10 colleagues in one day, the largest loss of life in the Gulf War, actually, in a single attack, as a result of the right wing blowing off, effectively, the outer part of the right wing.
Well, I never knew that. This is the kind of response we love to get from readers every time we publish an edition of The Aviation Historian, the journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of aviation history. Topics such as a secret RAF plan for a trans-global bombing raid on mainland Argentina during the Falklands War in 1982, or the inner workings of the Lewis machine gun, or the use of unmanned B-17 Flying Fortress drones in post-war atomic weapons testing, or what it was really like to be an Imperial Airways passenger in the 1930s. And now, after 50 quarterly issues over the past 12 and a half years, we are going annual. The same fresh, stimulating, high-quality content, but in a different package. Plus, we're doing books and specials. The Aviation Historian. We're print. We're digital. We're flying history for connoisseurs. But we're not on sale in newsagents. Find out more at theaviationhistorian.com.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
And you've kind of skimmed over this a little bit, but just for our listeners, just explain, 47th Squadron is quite a sort of a special squadron, isn't it, in a way? And it is sort of special duties. It's almost in the footsteps of, you think, kind of like the Lysander, in terms of dropping people off who were, you know, heavily on people off in places where they shouldn't be, who then, you know, kind of raise mayhem and do sort of certain things like that.
Well, we raised mayhem a lot, but that didn't have anything to do with operations. I'll tell you that. So 47 Squadron is, you know, it's a special squadron. I think it's fair to say that it, you know, it's got an amazing 100 years history. The squadron was retired with the last Hercules in RAF service, so the squadron was stood down on that very day as well. The squadron is special for a couple of things. The first thing it's special for is all the squadron members wear a tricolour flag, which looks a bit like the Czech flag. And people say, well, why are those people flying RAF aeroplanes if they're wearing the Czech flag, which is a red, white and blue flag, which turned into red, yellow and blue. And the reason for that is 47 Squadron is the only RAF squadron to have fought under its own flag. And that was during the Russian Civil War. The UK sent some RAF aircraft there, but couldn't be seen to be sending RAF aircraft to the Crimea and Ukraine. Okay. Sound familiar? So OC-47 at the time, Air Vice Marshal Collingsworth, who was Squadron Leader Collingsworth at the time, he ended up becoming the governor of Crimea, which became a little bit politically difficult. So they pulled the Union flag down and put this red, white, and blue flag up, which faded in the sun, which became a red, yellow, and blue flag, so that the Prime Minister could stand up in the Houses of Parliament and confidently and quite rightly say there were no RAF aircraft or personnel operating in Russia. And there weren't.
So this would be about 1919, correct?
Just around that time, yeah.
And Echo DH? No, not DH4s. What would they be?
DH9s, I think.
DH9s, yes, yes.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was DH9s.
Yeah, and did they have the kind of a yellow roundel on there? That these are not RAF planes.
These are not RAF aircraft, and these are not RAF people. They were all volunteers. Now, that volunteer thing followed through afterwards. So there are two or three parts of 47 Squadron. There is a main squadron, which is a tactical air transport squadron that delivers direct support to areas like 16 Air Assault Brigade, as was, and a few other small units around that. And then there were two smaller units within the squadron, which were volunteer only. And those two units focused on supporting other types of operations.
And was there a higher level of airmanship or skills that people wanted when you volunteered? How were you selected or chosen, if you like?
You know, drinking ability. No, I'm joking. No, the guys who ended up there are the guys who are at the top of the game. You don't go there if you're an idiot. People who are selected to go there are at the pinnacle of air transport. They are delivering the tip of the spear stuff. It's competitive. There are far more volunteers than there are slots. The whole unit is a very strong unit, but those particular individuals, some of which that we talk about in the book peripherally, are really at the tip of the spear and truly telling their story by standing on the shoulder of giants in this case.
So it's the kind of people who can fly a C-130, around the Mach loop at night on NVGs and not break a sort of sweat.
That's the main squadron. So the main squadron do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, wow.
These people are in a class of their own.
Fantastic. The Hercules. What's it like to fly? How does it compare to other aircraft you've flown? From looking at it, it's big, it's bulky, looks a bit of a handful.
It's actually not. It really surprised you.
Right.
It's really a simple aeroplane to fly with lots of redundancy, and that's kind of how it was built. It was built to be simple. I've found more complexity in flying the Firefly, if I'm honest, because you haven't got four mates to help you. As an aeroplane, I joke, but my co-pilot in Afghanistan, my last tour in Afghanistan, was a really amazing guy, and he was a full-time reserve who had come back after having been a wing commander and a boss of a Tornado squadron. So he'd retired, decided to come back, and he came back as a flight attendant reservist on Hercs, and we went off and did a thing. And he said flying the Herc on MVG at low level in Afghanistan was one of the most challenging flying he'd ever done. And bearing in mind, this guy was a Tornado A1 QFI. So he'd been there, seen it, done it, and thought that the Herc was the most challenging thing, which just means I could have absolutely rocked a Tornado, by the way, if it was that easy. But no, joking aside, he said it was some of the most challenging flying he'd ever done. But the aeroplane itself is exceptionally forgiving.
Yeah.
You could do lots with this aeroplane, and it would generally get you out of trouble. And, you can even fly it on one engine, as we might have told that story in the book.
Well, I mean, one of the amazing. I remember going to the. I think it was probably the Paris or the Farnborough show a few years ago, where they had the. I'm going to mix my models up here, but it was a civilian version of the J.
The LM100J. Yeah, I actually flew in it. Yeah. I think I saw you at Paris just after I'd flown in it.
And that was just utterly amazing. I mean, that was people looking at it going, am I looking at this the right way up here? What is he doing with it? Incredible stuff that display was.
So, and that really is one of the big differences between the K model, or the H model as the Americans would have called it, and the J model, which is the more modern six-bladed composite propellers, is it's got oodles of power. Way more power than the previous models, and that was the huge step up. When they first designed this and flew it, 70 years ago, you've got to remember, when I think of a 70-year-old aeroplane, I used to think of Lancasters, but I've flown a 70-year-old aeroplane. That makes me feel really old. But when it first flew 70 years ago, it was hugely overpowered because it was one of the first turboprop air transporters. Yeah. It really was. But they bolted crap on it. They put flares, chaff, every bubble that they put on it, made it draggy. And actually, that power was just eroded away. And by the time you got to sort of, 1990s, mid-1990s, the plane was struggling, because actually they had so much extra stuff bolted onto them for self-protection, lasers and, infrared countermeasures, chaff and flare. Everything you bolt on puts drag on it, and it affects the performance of the plane. And then comes the J with uprated engines, fantastic propellers, and actually took it back to that power to weight ratio that the first A model had. Different game. You've now got an airplane which is hugely capable, doesn't have the same challenges, you know, hot and high that the previous models did. Amazing, really.
Did you? What about the transition from the steam gauges to the glass cockpit? Was that straightforward, or did you kind of yearn to?
I never flew the J.
Right.
So I've only flown the LM100J, which is a glass cockpit, and I've flew the J model in the simulator. I've never flown the actual airplane, but. Everyone who did make the transition found it quite difficult, actually, because we transitioned away from steam gauges to a HUD as well. Yeah. And, you know, so that's quite a big change because your eyes are looking in a different place. And that's why initially the J model, when it came into RAF service, was given to the two tactical, the non-tactical air transport squadrons, which were 24 and 30 squadron. And they focused on that Pickford's van with wings, you know, they were proper truckies. So we brought it in slowly. Those two squadrons transitioned to the J model first and didn't do any tactical work in that airplane for a number of years. And actually 47 squadron and 70 squadron were the last ones to transition. And 47 actually being the very last to transition to the J, because a lot of the capability that we had in the, particularly the mini fleet of six aircraft that 47 Squadron operated, had a lot of things on them that the J didn't.
Right.
So there was a capability gap there. So for the customer, they kept the K model till the very end and then transitioned once that capability had caught up with the J model. And it was a long time. You know, we look at the A400 now and people say, oh, it's not got this capability, it's not got that capability. Well, actually, when you look at the J model coming into service, it was exactly the same. It didn't have those core capabilities when it came into service. It took probably a decade, if we're being honest, to get to a point where it was fully capable. And the A400 is kind of around that time now, I think, or not far off that.
It does take a time, doesn't it? I think people don't realise that stuff comes in and it's not the same aircraft that leaves service as when it enters service.
And it's just not practical for it to come into service having everything on it or being able to do everything. Because the cost of doing that, you know, in the production process of the aeroplane is phenomenal. And not everybody wants the same stuff.
Talking the production process, I mean, have you been out to the production line in Georgia?
Oh, I have. Yeah. it is amazing, actually. So I tell you what really surprised me, Tim, and this will probably surprise you as well. So the jigs that they used for the first airplane's flight deck are still used to make the flight decks today. That flight deck shape is identical to the flight deck shape that was the first airplanes. They still use the same jigs. So those windows, everything are identical to the first airplane that came off the line.
Wow. And presumably there must be people there working on the line whose father, grandfather maybe might have been.
It's a family business.
Yeah.
It is a family business. It's a bit. I know we're going to talk about Boeing later, but the Lockheed Martin is a family business as well. And, you know, what I found really interesting was the real pride and care they take in building every airplane, because every airplane is different because the customer wants something different. So they come down as a, you know, like a popular plus version as it comes down the middle of the line, and then they split off to go and have all the gear enhancements put on over here, or you can have the ST version over there, or, you know, whoever's wanting to buy what. And, you know, even now today, so we're 70 years on, there are new variants coming off the line. So, you know, the TACMO variant. So, you know, TACMO started off in a Hercules back in the 70s, and then since then it, you know, that was an A model. Since then it's been 707s, you know, and the 707 that flies around today is being replaced by a J model Hercules. So this will be a Hercules that will trail a 5 mile long wire behind it that will be able to communicate with submarines. So this is a critical part of the US's you know, national defense, and they're taking it away from a jet and putting it back in a turboprop, which I think is, you know, is amazing and really a real shot in the arm for the C-130 crew. But the most amazing one that I think is happening now, and, you know, it's been publicly announced so we can talk about it, is NOAA have just signed a deal to have 2 C-130J Hurricane Hunters. And I listened to the Admiral talk about what they're going to do with these Hurricane Hunters, and they are going to be able to predict landfall of a hurricane, any hurricane, to within about 50 meters.
What the heck?
Yeah, with about an 80 to 90% confidence on that. So, go on.
They're replacing the
P3, yeah, P3s, but it's an upgrade as well as a replacement.
Yeah.
So this amazing airplane is going to be able to drop drones into the center of a hurricane. It's going to be able to drop buoys into the water to look at water temperatures, and using all of this data, it will be able to compute landfall of the hurricane with that accuracy. And why is that important? Because it means now, rather than having to evacuate the whole of the west coast of Florida or the east coast of Florida, you can say, well, actually, you only need to evacuate these three towns. And the cost saving of that alone pays for the aircraft.
Wow. That's incredible. I mean, it's amazing the number of missions it's done. I mean, I think Roland was on our podcast also talking about Mosquito. He said, you know, Mosquito had done, I think he said, every single mission that was going from airliner to fighter bomber to night fighter to Hercules must be, I think, probably next in line. I don't think anyone's turned into a fighter yet. But
oh, well, you say that. It has just been fitted with air-to-air and air-to-ground missiles. And air-launched ICBMs.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you can, you the, what, the Rapid Dragon.
Rapid Dragon.
Out of the back and go and ruin someone's day with a load of drone swarms, I would imagine, would be in the future as well.
It's not in the future. It's a capability now.
Yeah. What's your favourite variant of Hercules?
The one with the biggest oven.
The one with the biggest oven?
Oven. Anything that can do large jumbo sausage rolls is my favourite variant. In all honesty, having seen them all, people are going to say, oh, it's definitely got to be the one with the guns, isn't it? Actually, the Compass Call Herc was mine. It was a PsyOps airplane. It still exists. It has some amazing equipment on it and can even broadcast television.
You got your mobile. There's a mobile TV station in there, which you know, presumably would be a little bit loud. But that's fascinating capability. There's even an amphibian version that I think
they've decided that it's probably not a good idea. In fact, we talked about this at the talk in Cambridge the other day because somebody asked a question about it, and I deferred to my learned colleague from Lockheed Martin, who said that a customer had come and asked them to do it. They'd looked at it, and this was like 15 years ago, and they decided 15 years ago that actually, no, it wasn't going to happen. Then very recently, in the last couple of years, a different customer's come back and said, right, could you do this for us? We really fancy this. This sounds like a great idea. An amphibious Herc. So they looked at it again quite seriously. And I think the advice from Lockheed Martin was, leave boats to the Navy.
Brilliant. I've got to rewind here a bit for the design. Is there any odd handling or cockpit design quirks in the aircraft you thought you know, from for 50 years ago, 60 years ago, that they thought, oh, hang on, what were they thinking here? You know, is there anything there?
No, I think there are some really good things that people might not appreciate. I don't think there's anything that's detrimental to it. I think that most people won't appreciate that the C-130 has two sets of takeoff and landing speeds. It has a what we used to call a tactical speed and a normal speed. And a normal speed is the kind of thing that you would get in an airliner. It provides you with the safety margins, you know, should you lose an engine or that kind of thing. And taking off in a Herc, that normal speed, probably, you know, normal weight's just a little over 106, 107 knots. The tactical speed could be as low as 89 knots. Now, what's the advantage of having that much slower speed? Well, actually, it's a lot less ground run, so you can take off a lot quicker and get that airplane in the air. But what it does do is it doesn't account for an engine failure. So I think if you read the manual, it says an engine failure whilst getting airborne at the tactical speed would be unsavory. So, you know, it's along those lines that you think handling might be marginal. All these little words that you think, we don't really want to be doing this too often. So we practiced it once every 6 months. We'd practice it, and if you had to use it for real, then you would. But also when you're coming into land, obviously the slower speed that you land at, actually the less the ground run. So the Hercules had two speeds for landing as well. It had a normal speed, which gave you normal margins on the stall, and then there was a tactical speed, which was a power on landing speed. And this is when you see Hercules come down into the ground and it looks like a carrier landing. Well, actually, that's the whole point of it, is that actually there is no flare. You basically just fly the airplane onto the ground with power on, and those spinning propellers are producing air going over the wing as well as the forward motion, which gives you that extra lift. So if you take the power off, the propellers don't push that air back, you lose your lift and you're going to fall out the sky. So you've got to keep the power on until touchdown. And actually the airplane was designed that actually deceleration would happen in the vertical plane as well. So when you hit the ground with those huge comedy tires, and that's why they are huge comedy tires with massive struts, it decelerates the plane in that vertical plane. So you boom, bang it down, all the oomph is taken out of the forward motion into reverse. The props turn around and produce 60% of the forward thrust going backwards. And you stop really quick.
Wow. And how's your spine after these landings?
Actually, you know what? At the front, it wasn't too bad. But as a loadmaster, the loadmaster would sit close to the parachute doors, right down the back, which is behind just behind the wheel wells, where the wheels are. You'd really feel it down there.
And that's obviously carrier landings. It's landed on a carrier, hasn't it? I mean,
yeah, not once. Yes. Not once, 21 times. Michael, Lieutenant Flatley, so this was when they were looking at a replacement for the carrier onboard delivery. They thought, how do we get big pieces of freight out? COD is a small airplane. How do we get something that's 40 tons out to, you know, out to a carrier? So he said, let's try it with a Herc. So they did, I think they did 21 full stop landings and takeoffs on the carrier. But then they also did 90 touch and goes. Which were times that he actually thought, nah, I'm not going to make this. Because once you put the reverse in, you were committed. There was no second chance. It was really quite interesting because looking at the figures, an arrested F-18 stops in 712 feet. The Herc managed to stop in 550.
Without an arrested hook.
No hook, no nothing. Yeah, it did. It was really light. It was a 50-ton aeroplane.
Yeah,
it was really light, and they were steaming into a stonking headwind. So he had all of that working for him. But actually, it's quite impressive, really, really impressive. One of the things that, you know, we talk about in the book, and I did give it a little go once, and it worked out okay, but it was a tough gig.
Why do I get the feeling from that that this is something like the late great Winkle Brown would probably kind of relish as the idea of slamming a four engine aeroplane?
He would have loved it. He would have loved it.
Yeah. And talking of hairy stuff in the Herc, what's your personal sort of hairiest mission? I mean, there's a great start to the book. I won't spoil it anyone, but what's your there I was nothing on the clock story where you thought.
You know what? There's lots. I've had a close brush with death, which I don't talk about. But we were saved by the co-pilot that night. The co-pilot was the only one, and we were literally seconds away from hitting the sea, and he was the one that noticed. And that's not in the book. So that was pretty hairy, and that was my fault. You know, hold my hands up. You know, we all make mistakes. To err is human. But I think from a pure flying point of view, and we do talk about this in the book, I think the loss of three engines in Afghanistan, that was a hairy moment, because I genuinely, myself and my colleagues, had no idea until after we'd landed what had actually gone on. And it was all user error, not our user error, but one of our colleagues. And you know, we'd been a little bit too clever and had ended up basically putting ourselves in a position where we would have flamed out all four engines had there not been a fault on one of them. And it kind of saved the day. But that was for me. That was a hairy evening. But you know, 20 minutes after that happening, we'd started them all up again, and we took off into the night over Afghanistan to save someone's life. So that was the reason that we did it. You know, there was a real impetus to get there to save a colleague's life.
And I think also that leads nicely onto my next question, which you know, the subtitle of the book is First In, Last Out, and I think that perhaps hints at that one of its biggest roles is delivering humanitarian aid, rescuing people from war zones. You know, it's a war plane, but it also delivers hope. I mean, would that be a fair assessment?
I think so. And you know, if we look at it holistically, I think it's done more humanitarian stuff than it has war stuff. Yeah. And certainly the humanitarian stuff hits the headlines more than the war stuff. But it's done its fair share of war stuff as well, not in the early days, but certainly, you know, the last 30 years, certainly since the start of the Gulf War, it has done almost solely operational work, you know, in those theatres of war, particularly in Afghanistan. In the early days of Afghanistan, it was the only way to get around was by aeroplane. And, you know, we were having to do that in daylight, you know, in a high-threat environment. And so, yeah, it has done its war stuff, but the humanitarian stuff, you know, if we look at great story in the book, Ethiopia, massive headlines there, and that would have never have happened had the Hercules not been able to airdrop those stores. It was the only way to reliably get that food and water to people, you know, and that's been the case numerous times, you know.
And that must bring you know, great job satisfaction there as for the Herc Force, for you know, air crew, for ground personnel, etc. You know, that you're going out there and you're on. There's some crisis on the news. You know, we're going out there humanitarian help, and yeah, what do you see on the news? It's a Herc, isn't it? Usually, or it used to be.
Yeah, well, yeah, it might be a Herc, but it's not a British one now. It'll be built in Seville now, with a French nameplate on it, not so much American.
So, I mean, that's a good segue into the next question: is replacements for the Herc. What do you think of what's there out there at the moment? Obviously, we've got the Airbus A400M, Embraer C390. What do you make of the replacement? Is there a replacement for a Herc? Another Herc?
You know what? And it would be easy for me to sit here and say, yes, the replacement for a Herc is a Herc, but actually, it is. I don't think that either of the aircraft you mentioned, the A400 or the C390, are a Herc replacement. They're different aircraft for different roles. You know, if we go back to the beginning of, and we'll start with the A400. When the A400 was being envisaged, it was a C-17 replacement. It was a C-17 killer. You know, it wasn't a tactical air transporter. It was kind of fitted between the tactical and the strategic air transporter. It was going to go, as the RAF always says, further, faster, with more. You know, it wasn't going to land in someone's back garden to deliver five blokes. You know, that was never the role of this. And actually, Lockheed Martin, as I'm sure you know, were involved in the initial partnership with the A400. They were involved in the development of that. When it kind of shifted and was going to become a Herc competitor, that was when Lockheed Martin dropped out and developed a J instead. So that was what the impetus for the J model. So the A400, hugely capable airplane. I've flown the simulator. It is a joy to fly, has its problems, but what airplane doesn't? But I think it's a great airplane for what we bought it to do. We didn't buy it as a Herc replacement, right? And we didn't. We've ended up in this because of political expediency and cost. You know, and sadly, that's going to feature everywhere, you know. It's just, it does the job just about. And eventually, it'll do the job. It's just the Herc went a little bit before, I think, everyone imagined. Yeah. Which, you know, is testament to we've hammered it for 30 years and it was needing a wing spar replacement. So, you know, that's how hard we'd work the airplanes they needed to go. The C390, now that's an interesting one. Now, Embraer are pushing this really hard. You know, it's a twin jet. It's really efficient. It is, but it's not a Herc. You know, interestingly, I saw some stats on this, and I'm not getting paid by Lockheed Martin, just in case anybody wonders. But the stats on this are quite interesting, that the Herc takes 20% less fuel to do the same distance than the C390. The 390 will be able to do the task faster because it's a swept wing jet and it's a bit smaller, but it can't carry the same amount. So although it's a replacement, it's more in the Transall category. You know, if you remember that stalwart, it's a bit smaller than a Herc. It's got a niche, but I don't think it'll ever replace the Herc. And I know some countries are buying it. You know, Portugal has recently bought it and some others. But they're not buying it as a Herc replacement. They're buying it for another role entirely. You know, this is a C-295 replacement. You know, it's the in that sort of that middle ground. It's not a Herc.
And crucially, have you compared the size of the oven on there? On the C-390?
I've actually been on it. Yeah. It is quite big, isn't it? And it's got a microwave as well, which I noticed, which was actually even better because you didn't have to wait on your sausage roll then. But no, the 390 is a lovely airplane. You know, we saw it at Farnborough when it was here, and you know, it is a beautiful airplane. It's just not a Herc, and I don't think it's a Herc competitor. It's a competitor, of course, it is because it's in that tactical space. But the numbers just don't stack up. You know, you're going against an airplane that's been in the marketplace for 70 years, has done, you know, over 1 million operational hours for something that I think they've sold 6 of now or 7 versus, you know, I think we're up to, well, it's well over 2,000 now, C-130s. And the line is full and the order book's full. So, you know, it's going to go for a few years yet. I don't think they're overly worried about Embraer's little toy.
I mean, talking of the production line, keep going on. I mean, we're now in a whole different world geopolitically. Let's put it this way, than even last week. Could you ever with the boost in talking about boosting in you know, defence budgets? Could you see the UK deciding to reverse the decision to get rid of the Herc and buy a handful again? I mean, France has got some. They're just They just seem to be for you know, special duties, special support, refueling helicopters. You know, Germany's bought them as well. So could you sort of see a handful being come back into service, or do you think it's that ship has sailed?
I think the ship has probably sailed, unless there's an urgent operational requirement. I would love to see a small fleet, perhaps five aircraft, coming to do some niche capability stuff like France has and Germany, because I think that the J model is best suited to that. The A400 not so much, just because of its size and its noise footprint, and that's not a capability thing. That's just a sheer fact. It's a much larger aeroplane and can lift more. But actually, in some of these niche capabilities, that's not what you're after. What you're after is a little bit more stealth and guile rather than to throw everybody at it. And the Airbus is a fragile airplane. You know, if we go and look at the landings that we did in at the end of the book, and I won't give too much away, but at the end of the book, the Herc is sent with a repair team of combat commando engineers to Khartoum to repair the runway to allow the A400M to land on it because they didn't think it would be suitable. It does have its limitations because it's a big aeroplane with a huge footprint. And that's not always what people want. So I think there could be a possibility that, you know, if we're standing up a new capability or we want to have a rapid capability, that might be around. But who knows? There's a long queue for them now. And you'd be at the back of a very long queue.
And really, I mean, it could be one of these 100-year-old aircraft. I mean, you know, if you look at something like the DC-3, that is still going strong. It was built, you know, that they built it solidly, and there's still ones there. It obviously not taking passengers, but still carting freight, doing geomotors.
Wow, still in military operational service. I was talking about this just last week in a tweet, which you might have picked up on. So, you know, 70 years is a record for the longest military production of an aircraft, which is held by the C-130. The longest in service, i.e. still operating as an operational military airplane, not like something like the BBMF, actually being used day-to-day as a squadron, is a C-47, and it's been used by the Mozambique Air Force. And they have Basler conversion ones, so they've got the PT-6 on their DC-3s, and they use them for anti-poaching. So they use them most days. So, you know, that aeroplane is still in operational service, so that's going to hit it. I think the Herc will hit it, and I think the B-52 will hit it. You know, especially with its recent engine upgrade with the new rollers. So the B-52 certainly will. It's going to go beyond 2050 now. So it will definitely hit the 100. You know, 100-year-old operational aeroplane.
Well, maybe longer than that. I mean, maybe 200 years from now, Mars, people will be, you know, looking at anti-gravity engines and dusting out the jigs and going, we need transport. What did they use in the olden days?
Yeah, and you know what? You know, you think about that now, that would be us flying a Lancaster operationally now.
Wow.
And we're talking about it. It is going to happen.
Yeah. Definitely. So what's the we've chatted a lot about the book. I fully urge people to go out, get the book. It's coming out in paperback soon. When is it coming out in the paperback?
May, beginning of May. Beginning of May, it's out in paperback. Out for pre-order now if you want to pre-order it. But actually, I think the hardback at the moment on Amazon is the same price as the paperback. So if you're so minded, you could have a hardback rather than a paperback. The picture, actually, I really like the picture on the front of both of them. An amazing RAF sergeant took those photographs and kindly allowed us to use them. He is an amazing photographer, and they're both the fronts of the books are his photos. Fantastic.
What's the reaction been from a book from fellow pilots, crews in the Hercules world? They seem like a fairly demanding audience. Book reviewers, aviation enthusiasts, general public.
So it was a Times bestseller, which is fantastic. It's like having a top 10 record, you know, on your first time out. First time you've ever gone to sing. So, as you know, I don't write books. I haven't. This is my first book that's come out. You know, I've.
Good luck.
great stories, not beginner's luck, great stories from other people.
Yeah.
And although my name's on the front of the book, there's a load of names in the back of the book of people who contributed to that. And the reason they contributed is I don't make any money out of this. All the money's going to the RAF Benevolent Fund. They've already received a check and they will continue to receive some money. And obviously I don't make any money out of it, but my co-author Lynn obviously does. But it's, you know, that has been a great way of starting my book career with a great subject matter, the Hercules, you know, really passionate about it. As you know, there are some more books coming.
So we can
talk about those in a minute.
Yeah. I mean, so as well as the day job in the aviation world, book author, you've also got a kind of third career. Are we on now? A TV presenter, producer, aviation documentaries. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, the documentaries came before the author bit. So I pre-COVID, you know, I was thinking about, you know, what am I going to do if this all falls apart? Because we're fragile as pilots, you know, we have a medical and who knows what's around the corner. You know, you could be here one day and gone the next. So I thought I've got to get another string to my bow. As most pilots do, they've got a side gig. And I thought, you know, I quite like TV. I'd love to bring some aviation stuff to TV. And I was very fortunate to be introduced to this amazing guy, Alan Haling, who owned a Warner Brothers production company. And we sat down and we talked about some ideas that I had. And about 6 months later, we ended up making a television program for National Geographic, which is currently on Disney Plus, called Air Force One, The Flying Fortress. Which I managed to get to go on Air Force One and fly on Air Force One with the Presidential Airlift Group for a number of times. It was fantastic. Wow. And interviewed then President 45, now President 47, on board Air Force One.
Wow.
Which was amazing. And, you know, nobody knows Air Force One like he does.
Amazing. Oh, so, I mean, that's incredible itself in getting an aviation documentary off the ground in the first place.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's a tough sell. Aviation is a really tough sell. And, you know, the future of aviation documentaries, I thought at that point that was it. But actually, I have been so fortunate to, off the back of that, I ended up getting a gig with Smithsonian Channel, which is part of Paramount Plus, doing a series called Artemis, following putting the first woman on the moon, the first of which has come out already, and that's expanded into a series that we're also doing for BBC and PBS, which will also follow those same ladies who are going off to the moon. And I've been very fortunate, and I mean honored, to be able to know these people, these astronauts who are so humble. And I saw Artemis 1, the first uncrewed mission, take off and go around the moon. I stood next Wow. to the astronauts on the grass outside the vehicle assembly building and watched that rocket take off, the largest rocket ever to take off from Cape Canaveral, you know, in terms of power. And it was loud. I can tell you, it was the loudest thing I have ever heard. You felt the sound rather than heard it. You couldn't hear anything. You was just obliterated by this noise. So that's come out. And then obviously off the back of that, you always get something else, don't you? So I was very fortunate to be able to follow the story of the last 747 being built.
Wow.
For the Smithsonian Channel and Paramount Plus. And the last 747 is a documentary which has kind of fueled the next book.
All right. Okay. So your other love, you know, what are you working on next? It's Jumbo. Wow. Can we talk about that?
We can talk about Jumbo. Yeah, of course we can.
Yes.
The last 747, I'm wearing the T-shirt today. I know people can't see it, but I am actually wearing the T-shirt.
Just have to imagine it, folks.
Yeah, the last 747 documentary, it was an amazing documentary to film. And you know, we interviewed Juan Trips, Sun, you know, we interviewed a phenomenal amount of Boeing employees who had, you know, 3, 4, 5 generations had worked at the Boeing factory. I was blown away with the access that Boeing gave us, which was just phenomenal. And we followed it from the laying down of the keel of 1574, the last jumbo, to it flying away from the factory. And, you know, for Atlas Worldwide, took the last jumbo away from the factory. And I stood there and I almost cried. I know this sounds really, you go, yeah, but it's just a plane. But actually, it was a momentous occasion for Seattle in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah, the jumbo jet had really saved that town, had saved the company back in 1969, early 70s, and really changed the world. And, you know, the book, all the stuff that we couldn't get into a 43, 44-minute documentary, being able to write a book with 100,000 words allows you to tell all of these amazing stories of how the jumbo jet changed the world. And I think people will be surprised to find out in the ways that the jumbo jet saved the world. And, you know, it's coming out. It's available for pre-order now. It's not going to come out until February. That's because we've just finished it. I mean, literally just finished it. So it has to go through the amazing edit process and all these other things. But it will be out in February.
So this will be the same idea, a little bit like Hercules in tying the last jumbo interspersed with the story. Wow, I can't wait for this. I mean, they bet the farm on it, didn't they? I mean, Boeing just bet the farm on it.
Well, actually, if we're going to go back to it, Boeing bet the farm on something completely different, and an aeroplane that a lot of people on this podcast might not have heard of, the Boeing 2707.
Yes.
Which was the Boeing SST, which was their Concorde equivalent. So Boeing and the United States government bet the farm on the 2707. And actually, they were pipped to the post. Yes. In fact, everybody was pipped to the post by the Russians. You know, the Tupolev 144 was the first aircraft to fly. It was the first to go supersonic. It was the first to go beyond Mach 2. So it was the record breaker, not Concorde, but Concorde obviously had the commercial success. And that killed, you know, what was then the only horse in town, the 2707. It was all the big engineers, all the money had been plowed into this program, and it was shut down overnight. And, you know, it was a big thing.
And it was almost like the jumbo was the kind of consolation prize. Well, you know, maybe we'll sell a few freighters, et cetera, you know, and
not giving too much away, but that could be the reason that the jumbo has its unique hump. It was always going to be the also ran, and in fact it ended up being the queen of the skies.
Wow. Okay, so jumbo or Herc, which one would you choose if you had to live? Or Lysander?
Oh, Lysander would always be on the list. It would be my top one. But actually, of aeroplanes I've flown, I think the jumbo. Because I think, although they're very different aeroplanes, the Herc's iconic, but everybody knew the jumbo. Everybody was jealous that you flew the jumbo. You know, it's a lovely aeroplane. But, yeah, that would be the one. But if I had a choice of, you said, Scott, whatever plane you want, we're going to take you flying in it tomorrow, it would be the Lysander. Because there's only a couple flying, and there's only one SOE one, which is the one at Duxford now. Is it at Duxford or I think it is, or Shuttleworth? I think it's Shuttleworth.
Yeah,
the SOE Lysander, the black one. And for me, that would be... That's a bucket list item.
Okay. Well, TV producers, listen to this. You've heard this there. We need a documentary on the Lysander SOE, BBC Two. We've got the perfect presenter here. Get it made. So I think we're almost up to the we're over the time a little bit here. But I'd just like to say it's been an absolute delight having you on the show, Scott. I mean, you know, from gosh, DH9s in Crimea to Hercules to the Jumbo Space. I mean, you are the consummate aviation professional and enthusiast. It's just so nice to have you on the show and just chat aviation. We've bumped into each other so briefly here and there, and we obviously interact on social media and stuff, but just fantastic just to just chat aeroplane, space flight, anything that comes into our heads. Where can we find you on social media, online, and where can people keep up?
So I'm on X, Instagram, you name it, I'm on it, at Scotty Bateman. I've got verified blue ticks on everything, so if it looks like me but isn't me, it won't have a blue tick. And there are a few imitators around. Or if you want to look at some of my TV projects, scottybateman.com, and that's Scotty with T-I-E rather than T-Y. So scottybateman.com, you can look at the TV projects, and there are some clips of the last 747, some of the Artemis stuff that we did for Nat Geo. And if you've got Disney Plus, get it on now. Air Force One, The Flying Fortress. Actually, I cannot tell you how amazing it was. Yeah, it's proper pinch me stuff to when you're sitting on the airplane, you look out and it's got that USAF and the big stars on it in a jumbo. And people are looking at you thinking, who is in that jumbo jet?
I mean, getting access for that must have been absolute, just, you know, I don't know where to start, where you would say, no, you know, I want to fly an Air Force One. What hoops you'd have to jump through?
Lots of hoops. Yes. 2 years. It took about 2 years from start to finish.
Wow. So, brilliant. I'm going to thank my guest here. Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Everybody, you know where to find Scott. And also, Hercules, hardback there. Paperback coming in May. It's obviously online as the Kindle. And then watch out for Jumbo coming in February. We're all going to be watching out for that. And so best of luck in the next... what's the next book after Jumbo, though?
Oh, now. I know what it's going to be, but I'm not going to give it away just yet. So I'll tell you, just a bit of a teaser then. The one after Jumbo, it is... the most secret place on earth, and I'm going to write about it. I have access to the most secret place on earth, and I'm going to write about everything it's done over the last 53 years.
It's Aria Fluton. Okay.
And I've got some pictures from a Canberra. Yeah.
Photograph from a camera.
Good guess. Brilliant. Though. Well, good guess.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really interesting as well. So thanks very much again to our guest, Scott. And it's bye from me. Hopefully next time we have Peter and the rest of the gang back. But stay tuned to Extended.
Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.